Hi.
Hello there. How are you? Hi,
I'm
John.
good. How
Guys
are
doing
you
well?
feeling?
Hi, this is Lucy Parry. You're listening to the Deliberative Democracy Digest. Today we're taking a deep dive into the topic of citizens' assemblies. I'm here with Professor John Gastel and Dr. Marjan Essassi, and they are here to talk about Marjan's new book, Activated Citizenship: The Transformative Power of Citizens' Assemblies. So, thank you both for being here. To start with, maybe you can just introduce yourselves and then we can get right into it.
Sure. My name is John Gastel. I'm a political communication professor at the Pennsylvania State University. My research brings together two topics: the study of group decision making and group dynamics with political communication broadly, and the intersection of those is where I've done most of my work.
My name is hi, I'm Marjan Essassi, and I'm based in Washington, D.C. I'm the executive director of the Federation for Innovation and Democracy North America, FIDE. And I have become very involved in deliberative democracy for the past 4 or 5 years as a result of a doctoral thesis that I was pursuing, which has now become my book, Activated Citizenship: The Transformative Power of Citizens' Assemblies.
Well, Marjan, let's start right there with the new book, Activated Citizenship. You use a problem-solution format where you lay out this is the problem with democracy, and then you present a solution to it. Let's start with that problem. You talk about trust in government, insecure voice. What is the difference between those two problems?
So I think that if I could just take a step back, John, I think the problem statement for me when I started this entire research was really, why are citizens in Western democracies disengaged from political institutions? That was part of my problem statement. And the second part was really asking myself in my research, are there platforms, are there interventions out there that once you do participate in, you want to continue being engaged with your government? And as a result of, I think, that statement, that kind of launched me into a whole area of research. And I would say that in the work that I was doing, the sort of the research that I was doing kind of cohered around three real deficits around our Western democracies mainly. The very first one was sort of our election myopia. And by that, I mean the fact that our democracies are truly defined by my vote. Citizens typically think of their involvement in their democracies through that vote, whether it's every 2 years, every 4 years. So that was part of the problem. And the other part of the problem was really citizens feeling more and more frustrated and disappointed because their preferences are not reflected in public policy. And so that was the second part of the problem for me. And how do they then, in between elections, hold government accountable for those policies that they have to live with on a day-to-day basis? And then the third piece was really marginalized voices. How is it possible that we are in a situation where we really only hear from the extreme voices, and that sort of we don't really have platforms where we try and seek the voices of those that we often don't hear about? So those were really kind of the problems around our democracy that I was really eager to try and sort of dig a little deeper in. And that's what brought me to citizens' assemblies as a potential. As a potential, I would say, complement to our representative democracies.
So put another way, if I am a member of a political party, let's say in Italy, that is ascendant, is powerful, influential, looks like it's going to win elections for many years to come, am I not having any of these problems? And am I feeling like the elections matter? My voice is being heard? I'm at the center, not the margin?
I mean, I think it depends on the citizen. I think that there are citizens in these countries who probably are feeling pretty good about their democracies, but can look around them and think that, the voice of the people around them are not being heard. I think, and I'm not sure if I'm touching exactly on what you're sort of putting your finger on, but I do think that even in countries where citizens are feeling pretty good about their lives and their democracies, there is an issue that we're having across Western democracies, which is around democratic process. I think that even that person that you described is probably more interested in outcomes than process. And that's one of the things that I find is sorely missing, certainly in the United States, when we speak to either members of political parties or heads of political parties or donors in this country. I think we have lost our respect for political process. And I also want to kind of go back, if I may, to something you raised around trust. I have written a little bit about this, and I think that we focus a little bit too much on trust in government. I get very uncomfortable when the health of our democracies is really defined by the level of trust that people have in their government, in their political institutions. I think that we should kind of change that a little bit and speak more about mutual trust, and how different processes might enhance mutual trust. And for me, one of the really attractive parts of citizens' assemblies is that regardless of whether trust actually increases in political institutions or not, the trust that the citizens who are members of the assembly feel in themselves to be real sort of voices in their democracy and have a place in their democracy is far more important to me than the trust that they feel for their political institutions.
Let me probe on that concept of mutual trust. What does the government or our governing institutions, or for that matter, the leaders in civil society, what trust do they need to have in the public in your model?
I mean, that's such a good question. Peter McLeod in Canada often talks about the fact that we've just got all of this wrong and that, we should stop thinking of the public as a risk and rather treat the public as an asset. I have become very sensitive, John, to at each of the citizens' assemblies that I've been involved with, and now there are about eight of them that I've been intimately involved in. It is really incredible to see, again, we talk about this in terms of like citizens' trust in government, but I think there is such little trust that government has in citizens to be able to come together, to learn together, to write proposals together. And, you see it all the time at every assembly that I've been involved with when electeds come and the comments are, across the board, wow, people are really committed in the work that they're doing. They're really dedicated. People are really smart. And so you see that change. And the other piece that I'll also say is that, these processes that I have studied, and I know you have been far more involved in some of these than I have, they also help with trust between elected representatives. So, for instance, in Brussels, the deliberative committee that I one of my case studies is on, the deliberative committee on homelessness that was a pilot project at the time. This is now 4 years ago, for the Parliament of Brussels. It has now become part of the Parliament. It's now it's gone from being a pilot to a permanent structure. What they do, which is very interesting, is they bring elected representatives in the mix. So they typically will have 40 citizens along with 16 members of Parliament. And what's really fascinating is the trust is not just between citizens enhanced trust in their electeds or electeds enhanced trust in the citizens, but you also see elected representatives who are through this process and as a result of this process are collaborating with each other in a way that they don't normally in parliament. And so that is also a huge added bonus or benefit.
Sure. So you have jumped ahead to citizens' assemblies, and we're going to talk more of those in a second about what they are and how they can address these deficits with democracy. Before we go down that road, I wanted to give you a chance to help the readers of this interview understand kind of what brings you to this, to devote your time to one particular federation or set of ideas, as you do, as you lay out in this book. There has to be something that kind of gets you up in the morning and keeps you motivated that is bigger than what you saw last week or the citizen assembly you're planning for next year. So, what drives you to care so much about democracy in the way you want citizens to care about it?
I mean, that's such a good question. And I'm not sure that I have a complete answer to your question. I do think that it's a fascinating process when you become older And in the process of doing a number of different jobs, you begin to try and trace your passion and your interest and what really drives you, as you're asking. I think, to be perfectly frank with you, part of, I think, my interest, and this came out when I was writing the introduction to the book, as I was trying to think about this term voice insecurity that I introduce in the book and where it really comes from. I come from a family. My parents are both from Iran. I was born in Geneva and then moved to New York. But about 6 months before the Islamic Revolution in 1978, well, the revolution was in 79, but we moved back to Iran in 78. My father had become an ambassador, and we left New York and moved back. And after the revolution, my mother really insisted that we would stay. And this was at a time when everyone else within our social media was leaving the country. And she was a little bit of a revolutionary. I mean, she really believed in the ideals of an improved government, potentially. I mean, that did not last very long, but she was the first person to really sit myself and my younger brother down and talk about this concept of voice. And this comes back in my work very much because I think that, those of us who grow up or spend a significant part of our lives in countries that are not democratic, I don't think we take democracy for granted quite the same way. And I have been, it has been, when I moved from New York to Washington, I was working in international development. So I was traveling all over the world, always working in governance, so trying to strengthen democracies around the world. And yet, I was raising two kids in Washington, D.C. And for the past 20 years, as I've been a mother, it has been very difficult for me to watch as America's promise of a democracy, in my view at least, has diminished, and that the leadership around me in Washington, D.C., really has not tended to this problem in a way that I think is meaningful. And so it's been very hard for me. And so I think, a number of different factors came together around 2015, 16 that led me to this decision. Part of it was I had at that point spent about 20 years in the United States, and so felt far more a greater sense of loyalty, I guess, to this country in a way that I didn't when I first started down the path of, I was in litigation and then in international development. I was raising two kids who at that point were teenagers, and I was kind of an adult who was giving them a country in a way that had a lot of problems. And then it was 2015-16 election that really just made it very difficult for me to justify continuing to work in international development when I felt like there were so many problems in this country. So I think that those are really the drivers. This is a very special country. And as I often say, I feel like we're marinating in democratic inertia, and not really doing what we need to do to really kind of bring it together again and to show some vision and some courage.
Yeah, so just a couple quick connections is at Penn State, there's an award we give each year called the Brown Democracy Medal, which is meant to recognize innovative work that maybe hasn't yet received kind of the level of recognition we think it warrants. And in 2023, it actually went to an Iranian human rights lawyer who is not well known around the world, but increasingly so. And I think she shared some of your mother's passion, as you described, that I think we can make things better. And it's a whole nother thing to be staying in Iran at this point. Obviously, she gets under house arrest and all sorts of privations on her and her family. It is hard, I think, for Americans to remember that it was a revolution from a Shah. And there was a hope that we could move past the more authoritarian role that they had. And a theocracy obviously proved that, well, there's many kinds of authoritarianism. And in the United States, that brings me to that 2016 election that you said was momentous for you. And it was for many others. The Agora Project at Johns Hopkins University and now many other campuses was inspired to some extent by the president of the university and a member of the board both becoming US citizens right in the wake of the victory of Trump and the Make America Great Again movement. And that kind of brings us all the way back to that initial curiosity I had, which is, boy, the people who won that election were kind of the opposite of what you're describing. I mean, they felt like their voice had been heard. They brought in their bull in the china shop to break everything in DC and were feeling pretty good about themselves. And then obviously 4 years later, they fall right into the description you have of feeling alienated, feeling betrayed, excluded. So this winning and losing thing has an interesting corollary in citizens' assemblies I want us to get to next. So let's pause for just a second and say, all right, so you've seen these problems, they come in different shapes and sizes around the world and at different times. And one solution to it is to convene a mini public, maybe specifically a citizens' assembly. So can you just kind of define that the most important term for you for us to understand? And then we'll dig in a little more after that. If this is the solution, what are its essential features? And I realize there are a variety of different forms of citizen assembly, and your book goes through cases that are very different. But what are the kind of essential features that make that term a meaningful one that can encompass all of those cases?
Of course. And I will, just as a side, I would love to know who the Iranian lady is who received the award, because I'd love to look her up if I don't know her already, so we can talk about that.
Nasreen, she's known globally kind of by her first name. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, she's incredible. Okay, so I think from where I sit and the work that I'm very eager to do around citizens' assemblies, I often talk about sort of the four non-negotiables of assemblies in my view. And the very first one is that a citizens' assembly is mandated and championed by a government body. So from the very beginning, it's very clear which government agency, which government body at the local level, the national level, the state level has commissioned this. Okay, that's the first piece. The second piece is democratic lottery. So, how do we actually bring those people in the room is incredibly important. And so, democratic lottery or sortition is the method that's used to be able to bring the most representative sampling of people in the room. And having done citizen engagement processes for about now 17 years of my life, there is no other body, though I think we could talk, we could have a whole conversation about sort of the limitations of our democratic lottery, certainly at this point, and it's not perfect, but it still does bring the most representative sampling of people in a room. And then the third component, I think, are the three phases of an assembly. So one of the things that really drew me to citizens' assemblies is this learning piece, which is always the first phase, the first and one third of the phase of a citizens' assembly. So, and again, how do we curate the evidence? Who does this? How do we make sure that there's a real diversity of perspectives that's presented? That's a different conversation. But the very first piece is the learning piece, which I think is fundamentally important to the success of an assembly. The second piece is the deliberation, and we have facilitators who should be trained, and sometimes I think should be trained better sometimes than they are currently, because there are lots of inconsistencies, but the deliberative facilitation and the deliberation that goes on. And then finally, the writing of the proposal and that final report. So, an assembly is not come and tell us what you think. An assembly is not tell us what your position is, kind of all over the place. It's really the drafting and the crafting of these proposals that are for policy change. And then finally, the fourth piece, and this is a really important piece, and I think it's one that we don't spend enough time working on at the front end, and that is government accountability and follow-up. So it is really important, in my view, that government be present at the very beginning of the session and government also be present at the end to receive the proposals and that final report from the citizens, and then to really clearly articulate the follow-up mechanism. So is it, we're going to come back to you in 6 months, we're going to come back to you in 9 months. And, regardless of the fact that for the most part, citizens' assemblies, I think around the world, continue to be consultative, I think this accountability piece and a really clear mechanism for follow-up up can help us have and create more policy impact, certainly, and make citizens feel that their time was really worthwhile, consequential, meaningful. So those are usually the four components that I talk about.
Fantastic. And we could drill down into any of those. We may in one or two. But let me try a couple questions on you, things I like to wonder about with folks. And one will be about process, and one will be about Impact. First, the process question. For years, I have been asking colleagues, can you point me to one concrete example of a well-designed, well-structured, well-planned deliberative process, and it would meet all your criteria here, that was an unqualified disaster? That is, everything was built right, the lottery went well, the facilitation was excellent, the topic was manageable, accountability was in place and everything, and it was just a catastrophe. What's the best case you've gotten? If you don't have one, you're not alone. No one has given me one yet.
So the best case of a disaster. So I think to answer that, or even to try to answer that, John, one would need to know how you define success, which is a huge problem, I think, in our field, because we don't have, I believe, and others could disagree with me, but a real sense of how we define success. So is it disaster in terms of policy, lack of policy impact? Is it disaster because government made a promise and then didn't keep its promise? How do you define disaster?
I'll narrow it just because that does happen with some regularity. The deliberation is excellent, the report is quite coherent, and nothing happens. That's very common. But I mean the actual process fails. The disputes become vitriolic and unresolvable. People leave. They just get up and leave with total frustration. They can't reach anything approximating a coherent recommendation. So it internally collapses in spite of everything being in place. And again, maybe just give me the best rec you have. If you don't have one, again, no one seems to be able to find one, but I think we'd learn a lot. In fact, there's a great article from years ago about we don't write enough about failure in democratic innovation. So what's the best worst process failure you've got, again, with the right pieces in place.
So, I will say, I do actually, one of my recommendations in chapter 7 is we need to sort of engage in more constructive criticism around our processes, because that's, I think, the only way that we're going to be able to improve our processes. So I have two answers to give you. One was, I think for me, a process where the final report was just didn't make a lot of sense. And so when the council members were provided with that report, they really didn't know what to do with it. And so to that was, but there were parts of that process that were absolutely beautiful. So I think that I wouldn't call it a disaster, because I still think that these processes, regardless, have, and we can talk, I hope, about impact and how I define impact, because I think that success and impact come in many different ways. But I would say that was a somewhat of a disaster. But I would, if you would allow me, I'd like to actually answer your question a little bit differently, because I've been very lucky, perhaps, because the processes that I have watched have all been incredibly civil. People are, I'll just give you an example, not of a disaster, but of a success. In France, the 185 people that we recruited for the second convention on the end of life, only one person dropped out. Of 185 people, 184 people came back to Paris for 9 weekends, 27 days, because they were so committed to the process. So I haven't been part of processes where people have dropped out in huge numbers, though I have been part of some processes where people have dropped out a little bit more. And that conversation between them is often incredibly civil. At a time in France was very interesting, because at the time that we were having the Citizens' Convention on the end of life, the Assemblée Nationale was going through the protests around the age of pension. And the fighting in the Assemblée Nationale, compared to the civility of the 185 people who were talking about proposals around the end of life, was really a stark, to me, example of how incredibly civil citizens can be. But I will say, to your question about disaster, I think that how I would like to answer that is that, in my view, we have certainly in Europe and in Australia, we've experimented with citizens' assemblies enough, right? So there are certain things that we now know about the process that works. But one thing that I still think, and I won't call it a disaster, but I will call it an area where we should really, really be thinking harder to make these processes sing more, is really thinking about how we can shift power. I still think we don't do a good enough job to really give power to the assembly members. We bring them together, and I think that's great, but I actually am finding it more and more frustrating when I see processes that really don't, that aren't set up or designed for co-creation, for real co-creation. And if you ever speak to citizens of an assembly after the very first session, they say, we want co-responsibility. We want to sit in governing councils. We want to be part of the media outreach. We want you to treat us as an equal partner in this. And I don't think we do that well across the board. So to me, that's a big red flag.
Right. So a couple thoughts. One is I share with you the inability to articulate a clear example of a disaster when everything was designed right. It's not meant as a trick question. I think sooner or later, one of these fantastic, well-designed processes is going to fall apart and it'll be really interesting. But I haven't seen it either. When things do go badly, usually you can point to a clear design flaw. I think you pointed to facilitation being more important than people realize. And I've certainly seen a mix of professional and very amateur facilitators cause very uneven results. I also think sometimes the issue is not well structured, the agenda is not well structured, and you end up with 67 recommendations about this, that, and everything. Even the Australian Citizens Parliament, which I was intimately involved in, came up with, a baker's dozen of ideas that were all broadly about something, but nothing in particular. And so I think that's a common problem, but it's kind of a design flaw again, not as an excuse, but as you say, something to learn from. I think this insight you have about wanting to shift the way power is exercised in these is interesting. So let me be provocative a little bit and say, I see how you could take your non-negotiables and say, I want the public to have a little bit of power in each of these. But let's start with that first one and kind of end with the last one. The first one is it's mandated by government, which sounds very top-down. And the last one is accountability, which you could argue is kind of bottom-up, but if the government just does the thing that the assembly recommended, where's the power there? I can't help thinking that what you're really asking for when you say co-creation is a little more of what Robert Dahl would call control of the agenda. That is, what is the issue that government is going to mandate? Are we going to get action on something government might be reluctant to take on?
Yes.
Is that something you need to add to your non-negotiables, or is that more an aspirational beyond the non-negotiables?
So that's a fantastic question. I think that, first of all, I just want to just add a footnote here. I think that all this conversation about disaster and there will be a disaster, I also think I really want to be mindful that this is a new area, and we also don't want to be afraid of failure. And we also want to really be open to experimentation. And so I kind of go back and forth between, wanting to be, because I'm totally a design nerd. Spend every moment thinking about how these processes can be improved on. But I also think there should be room for these mistakes and for experimentation broadly. So I think your question is a great one. And in the book, I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at it, but I do have under my recommendations in chapter 7 on page 248, I have guiding principles for co-creation, co-responsibility, and consequential voice. So those are my 10 recommendations for how we can actually shift power and make sure that assembly members and the broader public are far more involved in these processes. And to sort of now pay sort of turn to your very first question about the top-downness. So government champion. So I do think, as someone who has spent a lot of time in social movements and protests and all of that, I do think that there's a huge value that they bring to any society, right? But for me, it was really important because at this point in my life, I want to see real impact. And we're not going to see as much impact unless government is a partner. And I say that very carefully. I don't think government should dictate everything, but I do think we need government to sit down at the table with citizens. So one of the biggest things that I do write about, and I wrote about this for the French Convention as well, and I've been talking about it more, is the selection of the topic. So I agree with you that to me, it would be far more bold if government came out and said, these are three, four, five areas where we can think that we could change policy, right? There could be policy reform because, as you know, our colleagues who have been doing this for 10 and 15 years remind us, you need to be solving a public problem, right? We don't want to, we want to make sure the government in the end does something with these recommendations. So the best marriage is one where government says, I can move the needle in this area, and people come and they're empowered to make different change. So I do think that the model should shift, and we should be asking citizens to identify what their top topic is, what they would like to tackle. Switzerland did this with youth, with their youth assembly last year. They actually had the youth, I think it was between 16 and 24, vote on what topic they wanted to tackle. And I think overwhelmingly mental health was the one that was voted as the most pressing problem, and they tackled that. So, you know, I think that it requires a lot of thought in how do we create the right balance between this being a top down, because we are asking government to sit at the table, but also making sure that we empower citizens in the process.
Fantastic. I promised we would next go to outcomes and impact, and I know you're eager to think a little differently about impact. So first, let me just put a little box around something, which is I think everyone reading this interview cares about the policy impact of deliberation and wants it to be consequential for the voice that people have in these processes to matter. There's weeds to be gotten into about, you know, whether government has to follow a specific recommendation or just be responsive in some other way. But let's kind of grant all that because I think there's something in your book that is much more unusual. And I want to kind of draw people to that. First of all, it's just the use of the word effervescence, which outside of like a personal beauty care context is not a word you hear often in the United States. But that and political engagement are both important parts of your activated citizenship model, which is what these assemblies are supposed to be engaging, which gets beyond the specific policy impact to, as you say, kind of waking people up, you know, lighting up their civic spirit, making them effervescent. So could you talk a little bit about that? And in doing so, address the problem that critics like LaFont have with citizen assemblies, which is they just involve too few people. I don't think anyone's going to dispute that participating in these things is a magical, transformative experience for many, but it's an experience shared by very few, presumably even in the most ambitious model where citizen assemblies are regularized. So talk to us a little bit about this kind of impact that gets perhaps underappreciated and for how it kind of scales up from the assemblies.
Sure, I'm happy to. So on the first part, the sort of the impact piece. So yes, my book does sort of I divide an engaged citizen into five different parts, and I look to see how citizens' assemblies actually elevate or decrease those levels. And I think part of what I do in the book is not just kind of very Pollyannishly say, oh, citizens' assemblies are great because, oh, people are just more excited. I actually also document assemblies where people's level of excitement comes down, you know, reduces, is reduced as a result of, you know, promises that are made and not kept, or clear communication. You know, something is as obvious as process, when it's not communicated clearly to people in an assembly, it can impact those variables. So I think that those are all very important, but I think that Just when we talk about impact, and I think this is really important because this is what kind of causes us to, I believe, think very kind of be very one-dimensional or maybe two-dimensional or maybe at most three-dimensional when we talk about impact and citizens' assemblies. I like to think about assemblies in terms of seven different boxes and buckets of impact. And the very first one is one of my variables, which is learning. I think that the fact that our governments, I don't believe, are really investing enough in kind of enforcing, reinforcing, and informed citizenry, I think is a real problem. And you do see with assemblies that learning goes up, not just about the subject, but also about government. I mean, sometimes people for the first time are really face to face with how government is making decisions and how those kinds of compromises and trade-offs are made. So I think that's a really important piece. We've talked about diversity. Again, bringing marginalized voices to the table around citizens' assemblies, I think, is another huge piece of impact. Policies being reflected. I do think what you said, I think it is an important one. The other pieces that we don't talk about enough, and again, is one of my variables, is community, sense of community, social cohesion. We, especially right now in the US, when we talk about this epidemic of loneliness, I do think the power of assemblies to bring people together and to create the sense of belonging is really, really important. And again, my book does document places where it doesn't happen. And there are definitely small decisions in the design and the implementation of an assembly that can enhance these things. And then, as you mentioned, strengthening the civic muscle on different ways and voice, which I like to talk about again, if done well. And I do want to stress this because one of the things that I do often say is that the practice and the potential of assemblies are not really always aligned. And so really thinking about those decisions that we make in the process of decision making. And then finally, the transparency and the legitimacy. I think those are all really important pieces. And then last is collective problem solving, which is really a muscle that we don't engage with very often in our society. So those are kind of the ways that I like to talk about impact. But to answer your second question, which I think is a really important one, and of course, has raised a lot of criticism around assemblies, I think there are a few things. One is, I do think that the idea behind assemblies is not for them to happen every 3, 4 years. The idea for those of us who are advocates of citizens' assemblies is that every city, every country should have one every year. This should become part of our democracy. This is not meant that, this doesn't mean that we think that it's the only part of our democracy that should be fixed. There are lots of other things that we need to do. But this is one piece that I think should become more frequent, more consistent. And so, in so doing, then it's not so much that, oh, we only have 50 people that are engaged every 4 years or 150 that are engaged every 3 years. At some point, any one of us living in our cities might be called to serve on an assembly. And therefore, the criticism that it's really just a small number of people that are impacted, I think that criticism, in my view, is less is one that becomes is minimized. The second piece is, and I think that this is another piece that we need to work on better and improve our measures, is the connection between the citizens' assembly and the maxi public. So that's something that we are paying as a deliberative community, we're paying more and more attention to, but it's one that we can, from the very beginning, engage the broader public, whether it's in public education or providing opportunities for them to be more involved. And then I'm going to say something that may be a little bit controversial, but for me, a citizens' assembly is not a panacea. It is, again, one form of participation that we should be investing in more. And it is precisely the smallness and the slowness of a citizens' assembly that makes it so unique. And so I often will say to critics, I believe that this is not an either-or situation. We don't have to pick and choose. I mean, there are resources for us to be able to do a lot of these different things at the same time. And so, especially when we talk about citizens' assemblies, scaling assemblies, and creating online platforms, I'm really hesitant because I do think that by forcing ourselves to scale and to create online options, though I do believe in hybrid assemblies, I do think for various reasons they can be useful. I think that we shouldn't lose the fact that, or I believe the distinguishing factor, which is exactly and precisely the slowness and the smallness of the assemblies that make them so unique.
Let me try pushing back and get your response. Juries in the United States, they're at a low point in terms of the percentage of cases that actually go to jury, but in every county, in every state in the United States, there are juries happening nearly every day. And yet it's quite common to go through your whole life and never serve on a jury. So that's a huge number of juries, 6 to 12 people each, plus a couple alternates. And still it's common to never have contact with it. What I would argue is that you're not being ambitious enough. That is, it's not, I agree, it's not ex making the citizen assemblies larger. And I would even agree it's not making them more frequent. I sort of joked in my jury research that, well, clearly what we need is to arrest more people and send them to trial, because then everyone will get the civic benefit of serving on a jury. No, it's a terrible solution. But there are two things that the jury has that I don't think citizen assemblies do. One is an educational curriculum where they have a piece of it. So if you're learning civics in the United States, there's probably a unit on jury deliberation, and you get a mock jury and you actually go through it. So I would encourage, as we develop, I know Unify America and others want to create a curriculum, I would encourage thinking explicitly about how you would teach in schools. The things that happen in a real assembly. And so there can be simulations and informal variants that build on those principles. The second is about those actual official, still rare assemblies, even if they're regular, that I would push back and say, there has to be a way to connect the larger public to the ongoing process of that. So for instance, I could see digitally people following it, and having a process for filtering some manageable amount of feedback live in the citizens' assembly that would interfere with the privacy, the sequestered kind of small group-ness of the assembly. But I think on balance, it would be productive. So, what do you think about those two ideas that we should be simulating and modeling these things in unofficial capacities, and that in the official ones, we should still have channels to bring in a much larger scale of public input, even if it's critical?
Yes and yes. So I think that on the first question, I think simulation helps because one, in my, with FIDE North America, what we try and do is raise awareness. I think anything we can do to raise awareness and around what a citizens' assembly is and have people sort of live the experience, I think would be phenomenally important. Plus, I think that, we live in a democracy where we talk now a lot about civics learning, and I think it's wonderful, but we don't talk enough about civics doing. So I think that that would be a very healthy addition to our sort of push right now for civics learning. So yes, I agree with that. The second piece I think is a little complicated, John, and I say this because I do see the value when we do try and connect the maxi public with the mini public. I think that the broader public is very, or parts of the broader public are very, very interested in connecting to the mini public. However, at least in my experience, where we have tried to create, part on websites, allowed for public comments to be filtered in, the assembly members are not that interested. They're more interested in the work that they have been called to do. And I think that especially with really great implementers like MassLBP, who often will say, you are taking the place of the community out there that's not sitting here. They take that role really seriously. But I have not seen, so I think that it's important to think a little bit more about why do we want to make this connection? Is it to allow the outside to know about what's going on inside, or is it for the inside to know what outside thinks? And I think those need to be researched further. But regardless of that, yes, we need to set up mechanisms that allow for that and add value in that space. Absolutely, for sure. I also think something we haven't talked about is really funding. I think that, we would really really in this space need, I often talk about external factors that are influencing our work and internal factors. And I think externally, I think the donor community really needs to take a more serious and more long-term look and come up with long-term strategy around funding for these processes. And I think that will solve a lot of our problems.
Well, thank you. That's all the questions I have. And I hope it's been enticing for those who are reading or listening in, depending on your format. There's a lot of ideas in this book, as said, and as Marjan has alluded to, they are all spelled out in a series of case studies that have successes and failures that give you a sense for why each design feature is so important. And I really appreciate you giving us a sense for why this is important to you. Marjan, any last word before we close?
No, John, I just want to thank you for your time and really appreciate the time that you have taken. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Pleasure was mine. Lucy, I think you've got your interview.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, both. That was
You
really
have
great. I
been
just
listening
was
to the
relaxing. There
Deliberative
was like a
Democracy Digest.
listening
I'm
to
Lucy
podcast
Parry, and that was Marjan Essassi talking to John Gastel about her new book, Activated Citizenship. And we will put a link to the book on our webpage. Thank you to Marjan and John for making this conversation happen, and thanks for listening. Bye.